James 1:27 from our reading this morning is one of those verses that clarifies Christian life. It may also complexify Christian life. Any sentence that begins like this has to be important, right? Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this. And when you hear that, you know the speaker is done clearing his throat and is about to say something important. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God is this: to care for orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. So, yeah, just those things. Pure and undefiled. Pure and undefiled draw on the Old Testament language of clean and unclean. Things ready to come into God's presence and things that need to be cleansed to come into God's presence. So religion that is pure and undefiled is a life that can come without pause, confidently and humbly into the presence of holy God. For James, it comes down to what Christians do and what Christians don't do. What do? Christians care for orphans and widows. The concern for orphans and widows is front and center in Old Testament ethics. In every culture, the emotional traumas and pain associated with becoming widowed or becoming orphaned is easy to imagine. Some of you, for sure, don't have to imagine it. You've lived it. You're living it. Losing a spouse, losing parents, losing loved ones is at the heart of the hard part of life. In ancient society, there was also a profound social and economic suffering that went with it. Orphans and widows were generally considered the most vulnerable people in your society, along with sojourners in the land. Christians care for orphans and widows. That's what they do. The word for care is sometimes translated visit, which I think has the meaning of put your eyeballs on. Personal relationship, personal interaction. The Christian community is a place of incarnational love. It's one thing to be concerned about the plight of the poor as a category of society and wring your hands about it. It's another thing to care about the suffering of a poor person and to get involved to alleviate their suffering, to minister to them in their pain. It's another thing still to work to change the systems of society that ensure that some people are trapped in cycles of poverty and suffering. In our own community, for example, I confess I'm not sorry at all to see that old Oak Motor Inn be torn down, downtown on 11th Street. I'm glad for it. That place is terrible. Over the years, we've taken some food and some money to people living there who've called to ask for help. But I've wanted to keep a pretty wide berth. It's just a pitiful situation. I'm not sorry to see it go and see something else rise in its place. And yet I've been so impressed and personally humbled by the care and concern that certain members of our community have shown for the current residents of that place. And that's right and good to do so as well. Where will they go? Where will they live? What's the responsibility of the owners of that place and of the city and community to assist those brothers and sisters, those mamas and children, those orphans and widows to have a place to live? They're on the knife edge of existence already and didn't ask for any of this. Real world riches and poverty are much the backdrop of our whole lives and the whole backdrop of the whole book of James from the opening verses. Incarnational care for the most vulnerable in your community is the difference between hearing the word and then forgetting it, and hearing the word and letting it change you. Not being hearers only, but doers of the word. be doers of the word, not just hearers who hear it and then forget it. For James, theology is a verb. In this book, there is a great emphasis on our works as an expression of our faith. Without doing your faith, believing your faith is worthless. Without living your faith, talking about your faith is as useless as a screen door on a submarine. And it is for Jesus too. How many times do we see Jesus putting eyeballs on the sick, the suffering, the poor, outcasts, lepers? How many times? And not just putting his eyeballs, but reaching out and touching, putting his hands on the heads of lepers, his hands on the eyes of the blind, his hands on the ears of the deaf, talking with foreigners, breaking bread with sinners. He and his disciples spent their days in close company with all kinds of people who are orphans, widows, sojourners, sick, outcasts, in religious language, unclean. Jesus and his disciples ate with them. They traveled with them. They listened and whispered with sinners. And that gets us somewhere close to what Christians don't do, perhaps. What Christians do is care for orphans and widows. What they don't do is become stained by the world. What Christians don't do is become stained by the world in which orphans and widows live and have their being. Don't become stained by the world that makes orphans and widows out of God's children. What Christians don't do is become stained by the world. Maybe. I guess. As Kurt Kaiser used to say with a smirk, lots of luck with that. Lots of luck at being unstained by the world. It was after one of those line-blurring days that the Pharisees, the religious leaders always keeping a close eye on Jesus, couldn't help but notice that Jesus and his disciples came straight from a day with the poor and huddled masses to the dinner table without properly washing their hands. They didn't properly wash the stank of the masses off their hands. Gross. But theirs wasn't a hygiene complaint, it was a moral complaint. The hands they folded to pray before supper were hands stained with the world of sinners. The religious question was, can you pray to holy God with uplifted hands that bear the stains of the world? Jesus changed the question. Can you pray to holy God with uplifted hands that don't bear the stains of the world? On one hand, we better hope so, because with all due respect to James' comment, no one escapes the stains of the world. Think of a person who's cultivated a life of extraordinary virtue, such that in every aspect of personal behavior, he or she is blameless and without sin. You're imagining a saint, I suppose. If you're imagining yourself, I'd love to know you. Maybe. You're imagining a saint, I suppose, or at least what we think of as a saint, someone who does no wrong. But it doesn't take a person who's even minimally self-reflective to realize that personal, individual behavior over things over which we have some modicum of daily control is only part of the story. In the TV show Ted Lasso, the soccer player Sam was so proud that he'd been selected to star in an advertising campaign for team sponsor Dubai Airlines. But only after he'd gotten started there that he learned that the parent company of Dubai Air in the TV show, Cerithium Oil, was negligently and actively destroying the environment of Nigeria, Sam's home country. Awakened to this, his unknowing participation in all of this, Sam searched his heart and protested, and the team canceled its sponsorship with the airlines, dramatically in one scene putting black tape over the name of the airlines on their jerseys in front of all their fans. As is expected in Ted Lasso world, all ended on a feel-good note. It wasn't messy enough for real life. But then the whole premise of the show is about an American failed football coach coaching a British professional football team. So real life isn't much at stake here. But it is at stake in our lives, and all the ways our lives connect with the world through the companies we invest in and how they treat the environment, the universities we support and how they protect girls on campus, the politicians we vote for and what they vote for, the wars the empire wages and how it treats our enemies and our allies, the food we eat and how the animals are treated where that food comes from, the clothes we wear and who made them. It's a complete fabrication that any of us are islands who live disconnected from the web of relationships of the world. We may or may not think we're of the world, but we for sure are definitely in the world. We're all implicated, if you think about it at all. It's hard to see a way out. And only a very self-righteous, self-unaware person would be pious enough to think they've opted out. And so let's opt to go deeper in. If we were really serious about living, how does James put it, unstained from the world, we'd have to live in a hole in the ground. It's a messy world. It's messy out there. It's beautiful and awful. It's holy and profane. It's hopeful and terrible. Oh, wait, did I say out there? I meant in here. And here, that's where Jesus points. He said, your religious piety is focused on not getting the stain of the world on your hands, but give me a break. Where you should be looking is inside. Inside you is beautiful and awful, holy and profane, hopeful and terrible. And that's true for everyone. It's a messy world of messy lives. Goodness, we need Jesus. In Jesus, we see that getting your hands dirty isn't just an unfortunate consequence of living in a fallen world from which we can quarantine into religious community. It's also a calling that Christians have in the world to go on, get in there, do the work. The inner spiritual work of digging deep into your being, even knowing there's some stuff in there you don't want to deal with, but you know you need to do that work. And do the work of incarnational love in a world that often eludes easy answers and neat solutions. Life's not pretty, and love isn't pretty all the time. But it's always beautiful. It's pretty messy a lot of the time and doesn't fit into neat categories. Love at the wedding altar is pretty. Love at the bedside of the hospital bed is beautiful. Jesus was not timid to get his hands dirty, and neither are we. If you're going to care for orphans or widows, or refugees, or the hurting people around you in your household or in your neighborhood, you're going to get your hands dirty. If you're going to care about issues of justice and injustice and broken systems and peacemaking and life building, you're going to get your hands dirty. If you're going to really care about your own redemption, the cleansing of your own soul, you're going to get your hands dirty. And if they're not yet, you haven't even started. James describes our redemption as receiving the implanted word of the gospel that saves our souls. the implanted word of the gospel that saves our souls. The root of implanted is plant. Things that are planted are seeds planted in soil. Anyone who works with seeds planted in soil gets their hands dirty. But that dirt is holy too. It's the soil from which we were all made by the holy hand of God. It's the stuff of true life, of relationship, of incarnation. Can you pray to holy God with perfectly clean hands uplifted that don't bear the stains of the world? I don't know. Maybe you can. Maybe if you're a saint. Maybe you'll tell me that you can do this. I certainly hope, as we're able, we always move toward holiness in all aspects of our lives. As we do, let us also remember this. After his resurrection, the disciples recognized Jesus by his hands, the hands that were laid on the heads of lepers and touched eyes and ears and children, the hands that broke bread and blessed them. The hands Jesus raised in blessing were stained with the dirt of a hurting and broken world being redeemed by his compassionate love and his death. They were stained with the tears of men and women he healed by his touch. And ultimately, those hands were pierced with the nails of the world. My brothers and sisters, it is said that you are the body of Christ. And so those are your hands too.